in this part of Focus 580. We'll be talking with Matthew Brzezinski. He was staff writer for the Wall Street Journal in Kiev and Moscow from 1996 through 1998. Before that, he reported from Poland and other Eastern European countries for a number of publications, including The New York Times, The Economist, The Guardian, and The Toronto Globe and Mail. He is currently a freelance writer. His work has most recently appeared in The New York Times magazine. His home now is in Washington, D.C. This morning, we'll be talking about a book that he's written that's based on his experiences in Russia in that period, 1996 through 1998, when the country was rushing headlong into capitalist market economy. The title of his book is Casino Moscow, and the subtitle, A Tale of Greed and Adventure on Capitalism's Wildest Frontier. It's published by the Free Press, in which he tells some rather remarkable stories of his experiences during that time that is seems to be something of a combination of what happened in this country on Wall Street in the 80s with just a dash of Chicago in the 20s. We'll have more as we talk with Matthew Brzezinski. And as we do, of course, as always, questions are welcome. Maybe you'd like to call in, share with us your thoughts, make comments, ask questions. That's certainly fine. All we ask of callers is people just try to be brief so we can get in as many people as want to be a part of the show, keep things moving, but anyone's welcome to call. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line. That means if it would be a long-distance call for you, you're in Chicago, southern Illinois, western Indiana, any place the signal will travel, use that number, 800-222-9455. Again, 333-WILL and toll-free, 800-222-WILL. Mr. Brzezinski, hello.
Yes, hello.
Thanks for talking with us.
Oh, my pleasure.
We appreciate it. You apparently had, before you went to have this stint writing for the Journal in 96, you had been in Russia at least one time before. You mentioned the fact that you had been there, I think, in 1992.
That was the first time I'd been in Russia.
Okay.
I had gone on several more occasions and traveled throughout some of the other former republics, such as Belarus and Ukraine.
Hmm. I guess what I'm interested in is maybe you're talking a little bit about how what the differences were in what you saw when you were first there in 1992 and then how things had changed when you went back there in 1996.
Yes, incredibly stark, night and day. I remember when getting off the train in Moscow in 1992, and it was already evening, and all the street lights had burnt out and hadn't been replaced, and there was such a gloom about the place. When you walked around storefronts, there was nothing but dust in the windows. They had, you know, maybe 10 or 15-year-old cans and things that they were displaying, but, you know, virtually no goods. When you looked at the people, they wore these, you know, these plastic shoes with Velcro straps and these, you know, gray rayon pants and shirts. And I was struck that, you know, that this place, which looked like it had just suffered through a war, had just a year before that been considered a superpower and had inspired fear in us in the West and in the United States. It was really, really shocking. I sort of said, boy, you know, this was a heck of a fraud. If we were frightened of these guys, they look like a bunch of beggars.
Hmm. And then what happened when you went back in 1996? What it sounds like it was so stunning was just how different things were and how many people seemed to have money and lots of money and enjoy spending it and maybe even enjoy almost throwing it away.
Oh, I mean, it was literally like stepping into the Las Vegas Strip, where the Russians had strung neon just about everywhere in Moscow to add splashes of color to this, to what had been such a gray place before. And I remember coming in. I had come in. There was a big snowstorm. It was in the middle of winter, and it seemed that every second car I saw was a Mercedes, and not just any Mercedes, but the biggest, most expensive Mercedes, or BMW, or Audis, and indeed, the, you know, Russian consumers who had been denied everything for so long, all of a sudden weren't denying themselves anything, and this was a place when you're these storefronts, which before had nothing but old tin cans, were now displaying, you know, solid gold bathroom fixtures and new stereo systems and sable and mink coats, and it really was an incredible contrast in those five short years.
Yeah. I like when you're talking about not only how freely people spend money, but how, in fact, people seem to like paying too much for things. I like that you tell the joke at one point, or there's a joke about the one guy who comes up to the other guy on the street, and he says, how do you like my new Hermes tie?
That's right.
I just bought this in Paris. I paid $900. And the other guy says, you fool, you could have gotten the same tie down the street for $1,500.
Well, you know, in retrospect, it's not surprising. This was, you know, the new rich or the newly moneyed are kind of an interesting breed all over the world. But in a place like Russia, everyone had been poor, and all of a sudden, this country with tremendous and vast natural resources. You know, the place is dripping in oil. It has almost as much oil as Saudi Arabia, almost as many diamonds and gold as South Africa. And all of a sudden, this, which had belonged to no one because it had belonged to the state, was up for grabs. And if you were clever, strong, you could grab this, and people did. And almost overnight, people, through one way or another, had bribed somebody and managed to export, say, you know, a few trainloads of oil or coal, and had $30 or $40 million deposited in their Austrian or Swiss bank accounts. Mm-hmm. And they pretty much went crazy with this money, and they weren't very sophisticated shoppers. So the way they judged quality was by the price tag. And interestingly enough, a lot of American companies exploited this. Particularly I can think of one interesting example is Philip Morris, which in the United States sells and markets a brand of cigarettes that's sort of a knockdown brand of cigarettes, and mostly students at universities smoke it. It's called Parliament. Mm-hmm. Somebody was very clever in Russia, and they essentially doubled or even tripled the price of these cigarettes. And all of a sudden, these cigarettes became the brand of the new Russians, the new rich, and they were a runaway success. And little did these new millionaires know, but they were smoking the exact same cigarettes that impoverished students in America smoke, and they thought that these cigarettes were the highest quality you could get. And there were many other examples of
them. Yeah. I think there's another example you'd give of someone that you knew, or maybe it was just a restaurant that you were familiar with, where the guy who ran the place had bought some Spanish wine, and it really wasn't very good, and nobody was interested in drinking it until he tripled the price, and then suddenly people couldn't get enough of it.
This happened all over the place with all sorts of crazy products that you know, very clever Westerners were unloading on these very unsophisticated consumers. It's changing a little bit in that the new Russians have now, you know, had a decade of exposure to Western goods and Western culture, because it was the same thing with Western culture. Any TV show, any film, any magazine, as long as it was American, was seen to be the be and end all. And of course, there, you know, we produce some very good films, but we produce some incredible junk, and that was all being shipped out there. But because in the old Soviet days, you know, this had all been off limits, and you could go to jail for bringing in, you know, even something as innocuous as Time magazine or Playboy. You know, when the Russians got their hands on this, they thought that they'd won the lottery, and they just couldn't distinguish between what was good and what was bad.
Our guest in this part of Focus 580, Matthew Brzezinski. He is currently a freelance writer, but between 1996 and 1998, he was staff writer for the Wall Street Journal in Kiev and Moscow. And before that, he reported from Poland and other Eastern European countries for a variety of publications, including the New York Times, The Economist, the Toronto Globe and Mail. His new book is Casino Moscow, A Tale of Greed and Adventure on Capitalism's Wildest Frontier. It's published by the Free Press, and it's based on his experiences, what he saw during that time in the late 90s in Russia. Questions welcome, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Well, certainly one thing that's true is that everyone wasn't getting rich. Who indeed was it that was benefiting by this this shocking economic change?
Largely two groups, the gangsters and government officials, or former government officials. Now, the Soviet system was a gigantic bureaucracy. And like any bureaucracy, if you knew decision makers, you could get a lot of things done. And in 91, some of the more clever bureaucrats decided that, well, we have an in towards all these natural resources or semi-finished goods, and we will essentially privatize them for ourselves. And so it was not surprising to see, you know, often deputy prime ministers or people high up in the ministries that almost overnight became multi-millionaires because they effectively just stole the state's property. And in Russian, this is called privatizatsiya, which is kind of a play off words, meaning grabocracy. And of course, there's the other category is the gangsters. And this also, ironically, has its roots in the Soviet system, in that you know, the Communist Party was essentially the world's largest mafia organization, and it enforced its stay in power by using intimidation and fear. And so during the late 1980s, when there was the perestroika under Gorbachev, and then of course in the early 90s, this was the way of getting anything done was to intimidate and to threaten. And you often had this sort of sports clubs with wrestlers and boxers turn themselves into business, quote unquote, associations. And they went around terrorizing the neighborhood and demanding protection money and buying off policemen and politicians. And very many of these petty thugs became extraordinarily wealthy and then set their sights on not just ripping off the little corner store, but taking over, you know, aluminum factories, oil refineries, and many of them pulled it off. And some of these folks became, you know, worth hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars, and they employed private armies that sometimes were 1,000, you know, 1,000 strong, and they almost ran little states within states. And to some extent, although less so, this continues today.
Mm. One wonders when you read stories like this whether all of the new Russians, the new rich, the people who managed to profit greatly by the change in the economy and the privatization of former state-owned enterprises and so forth, that all the people who got rich, was this all done illegally? I mean, were there any people that were just really, you would say, really smart and ambitious and made the system work? Or in some way or another, was this really all the result of lawbreaking?
There were people who tried to do it legally. But in a place like Russia, you cannot do things legally because the laws, at the time, all of a sudden everybody was told, be a capitalist. And yet all the laws of the Soviet system, which had not yet been rewritten, were laws that were intended to counteract capitalism. Being a businessman during the Soviet era was being a criminal. It was illegal. And so to become a businessman, since the laws had not been rewritten, you often had to violate the laws. And the moment you violated one law, then immediately you exposed yourself to the tax police or the Ministry of the Interior, and which meant that you had to either bribe people or sort of work in the shadow economy, do your business off the books. And as I was told by dozens and dozens of businessmen, you know, that yes, we would love to do everything above board, operate legally, but if we did, we would effectively go bankrupt because the tax rates, for instance, were 110%. So you'd be working for, and you'd be giving everything over to the government. And the government just didn't change the laws. And by the time it started changing the laws, well, the whole system had been ingrained. And the corruption literally ran from the very, 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 very top. It's not a coincidence that President Putin's first act when he took over the reins from President Yeltsin on New Year's Eve of 1999 was to offer Yeltsin and his family immunity from prosecution. And this corruption ran all the way down to the very pettiest of bureaucrats, or the underpaid policemen, who to earn a living had to give out, you know, all sorts of tickets and would pull you over and be very creative. And I got a ticket once for an improperly stored toolkit. And other officials would. I have a colleague whose grandfather passed away, and he was not one of the new rich in Moscow. And he needed to cremate him. The government officials wanted an $800 quote unquote facilitation fee to get the permit to cremate him. And they couldn't. This family was not well off, and they couldn't come up with the money. And it was winter, so they left their grandfather out on the balcony for 3 months while they scrounged up the money to cremate him. And I mean, this is a very morbid example, but it certainly tells you that, you know, it's very difficult to try to do anything legally in a society that is where corruption is as deeply ingrained as it was in Russia and continues to be.
Yeah. Well, I mentioned that before spending this time in Russia, that you had been in Poland and other places in Eastern Europe, and in a sense covered the same kind of story, and yet the story played itself out very differently. Why is it, for example, that the experience of the economic change in Poland was so different from the experience in Russia?
Well, there's a great many reasons. One would be that, unlike Russia, places like Poland or the Czech Republic or Hungary under the communist era had dissident movements. And Solidarity, for instance, in Poland during the 80s, as I'm sure you'll remember, was a hugely influential opposition movement which counted a member in just about every family. And so in 1989, when communism was toppled in places like Poland and the rest of Central Europe, you had people like Wałęsa, Václav Havel, who come to power. And many of the communists were thrown out of government, whereas in Russia and other parts of the Soviet Union, the very same people who ran the show in the old days continued to run the show. It's just that they ran it for profit for themselves later on. And of course, in places like Poland and Hungary and the Czech Republic and the Baltic states, these countries had enjoyed Western influences, and they were much more European, and they were very desperate to become part of the West. And whereas Russia was never so convinced that it wanted to be part of the West, it liked a lot of the West's gadgets, like the cars we drive and the cell phones we use, but some of the ideas that we have, ideas that government is for the people and not the other way around, this they were always a little skeptical of. And in Poland and Central Europe, the politicians really did make the very difficult and painful decisions to push through the difficult reforms that were necessary to introduce truly Western style economies where there is rule of law, where politicians are accountable, and you know the effects were seen very, very quickly.
We are getting close to the midpoint of the conversation, and again, I'd like to tell people who are listening, if you have questions or comments, you can call in 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Our guest, Matthew Brzezinski, and the book is Casino Moscow. It's published by the Free Press based upon his experiences there, some of what he saw from 1996 through 1998 when he was writing for the Wall Street Journal. I'm curious about how it is you ended up getting the job with the Journal. I don't believe that you were particularly, you didn't, economic reporting for you, business writing wasn't particularly a specialty, and yet this was in large part a business story, or at least you were covering a big economic story. How did you end up getting this job?
Well, I had worked in Poland and during the first half of the 1990s, and essentially the story sort of died in Poland, in that Poland was a success. It was already, people were talking about joining NATO and joining the European Union, and there was stability and the economy was growing. And in journalism, where prosperity is often wipes you off the front page, so to speak. But of course, this was just beginning in the former Soviet Union, and the opportunities were really in covering business. And I wasn't necessarily that worried about not knowing that much about business, because I was going to a part of the world where nobody knew anything about business. And I remember one of my first assignments was to go to the Ukrainian Stock Exchange, and which was very, they had just started it, and it was extremely hard to find. There was not even any plaques or addresses. And when I walked in the building, there was a babushka and a kerchief and a broom sweeping. And I said, "Well, is this the stock exchange?" And she said, "Well, I think they do something with money upstairs, and I'm not sure." And I went up there, and there was a dozen or so traders sort of slumbering at their desks, and not much was happening. And I introduced myself to the chairman of the stock exchange, and I said that I was from the Wall Street Journal. And he said, "The World Street Journal? What country do you represent?" And I sort of said, "Well, no, Wall Street, and it's in New York." And then he said, "Oh, I see." And I just started asking him the very sort of basic questions that I had asked my colleagues, that, you know, that what are the basic questions you ask in any stock market? And one of them is, what is your market capitalization? In other words, what is the size of the stock market? And of course, nobody over there knew what the term market capitalization was. And nobody had any idea what price-to-earnings ratios were. So, you know, it did make me feel better that I was covering people who did not know that I was not a seasoned financial reporter, because everything was brand new. And in a sense, you would have better training being a crime beat reporter and covering business in that part of the world than actually having worked on Wall Street. Because had you worked on Wall Street and went over there, you would see that you know, banks in that part of the world, for instance, don't lend money. I mean, they're called banks, but they have nothing to do with the banking system as we know it. And the capitalism that existed over there was, I think, more reminiscent of the capitalism that we had here maybe 100 years ago during the great Robert Barron era and during the late industrial age.
We have a caller to talk with. Others are welcome. Let's go here to Urbana for caller on line number one. Hello.
Yeah, there's a this is a good opportunity to check a weekly out of Boston called the Boston Phoenix. Last year ran a article called "From Russia with Lust." It was about two kids from Boston, Mark Ames and Matt Taibbi.
Right, they run the Exile. Uh-huh.
Right. Did you have much truck with them while you were there? Or?
We did our best to give them as wide berth as possible. I think they write a very sort of salacious weekly or biweekly. It kind of depends on their relative sobriety and finances. They're actually very smart and intelligent, and I think they tend to sort of poke fun of mainstream journalism and sort of play up the more salacious side of Moscow, and they call Moscow Babylon, and I think, you know, in a lot of things they say, they're absolutely right. And Moscow is a city where anything goes, where anybody can be bought, where there are no rules. And if you're a moneyed young bachelor, Moscow is indeed a very, very interesting place to be. And this is some of the things that they chronicle.
Yeah, they particularly lament the fact that nobody told them how beautiful the Russian girls are. But let me read a couple paragraphs about something that they wrote and get your comment.
Sure.
They were interviewed for the Boston Phoenix, and they were asked to talk a little bit about American business interests in Russia. And they said American big business wants Russian natural resources. Russia has a third of the world's natural gas, tons of platinum, gold, and diamonds. In an ideal situation, the evil American corporations would want it to be a toothless banana republic, and basically that's exactly what it's become after the reforms were dictated. Then Matt says, one thing that's underreported is the phenomenon of Western companies buying stakes in Russian military factories that then stopped producing. Siemens, for instance, bought a stake in a submarine factory. Now it doesn't produce anymore. Boeing, Pratt and Whitney, all those military industrial complex companies are all over Russia.
Sure, but what would you prefer having? The Soviet Union with thousands of nuclear warheads pointed at us, or a toothless Russia that supplies cheap oil? I think that, and they're absolutely right that in the disarmament programs, and I've been to nuclear submarine factories, shipyards. I've been to the place where they made the SS-19s and the SS-24, which are the ICBMs that each, you know, the missiles that carried 10 warheads. And it's true there are Americans at all those places, and they are giving them civilian contracts. And one of the reasons this is being done is the last thing you want is a great many of those scientists that worked in these places being all of a sudden unemployed and embittered, and then receiving an offer to go work in a place like Iraq or Iran.
Well, here are a couple of Americans who disagree 180 degrees with you, who think that the only reason that we're going in there, I mean the primary reason we're going in there buying up factories and shutting them down, is that we just want the natural resources, and that we consider Russia a big breadbasket for us, and it's a great opportunity for us to go in there and rape the country, basically.
Well, the Russians are smarter than we think in that they're not letting us have the natural resources. During the big bubble when you could buy stocks in just about anything, you could not, and to the great frustration of, you know, the Exxons and the Mobiles and the Texacos, you could not get in there and get oil. The Russians kept the oil, they keep the diamonds, they keep the natural resources, the platinum and so on and so forth. They keep that for themselves. In terms of disarming Russia, I'm all for it, and I think that the Clinton administration has come under a lot of heat for sort of turning a blind eye to the corruption that existed in that part of the world. But I think they successfully did demilitarize large segments of their industry, and a wounded bear is a very dangerous bear. And Russia's been humiliated, and Russia's angry, and anti-Western sentiments are growing there. I was just in Moscow last month and doing a couple of stories from the New York Times Magazine, and even amongst the liberal intellectuals, there's a lot of anger at the West. And I think that the less potential they have for wreaking havoc in the world, the safer we'll all be, and the safer, you know, especially Europe will be.
With just a little bit of insight, you can see why so many people would like us to engage in a little bit of disarmament ourselves. Thank you.
All right. One thing that I haven't mentioned, and I don't know how much difference to make to anybody, but your uncle is Zbigniew Brzezinski, who was President Carter's national security advisor. When people in Russia found out that you were his nephew, did it affect the way they thought about you and treated you?
Oh, very much so. I guess growing up in a household where the Russians were not always very popular, because we were political refugees. This is how we ended up in this part of the world. The Stalin invaded Poland, and we all had to flee. It clearly colors your perception of the country, and of course makes you more less trustworthy than you would otherwise be. But you know, on the other hand, the Russians to this day, if you ask them, you know, the name sort of the most fearsome anti-Soviet politicians and statesmen in the United States, they will single out my uncle. And on one or two occasions, I was confronted with people saying, "Well, we shouldn't blame the sons for the sins of their fathers." And sometimes, you know, you would, particularly when going outside of Moscow into the provinces where mentalities were, you know, hadn't been changed as much, you would encounter hostility, very much so.
Let's go to another caller. This is Chicago. It's line number 4. Hello.
Speaking of blaming for the sins, it seems that in order to establish a law and contract and other banking systems, a team from Harvard went to Russia, as I understand, and seemingly
got themselves into trouble too, right?
Resist putting their fingers into the pie, and consequently, I understand they were fined for having done so. You had heard about that, hadn't you?
Oh yes, very much. We were, the Journal is one of the papers that broke that that story. You know, the thing about Russia is that when going there, sometimes you'd end up in a moral vacuum, and it was a very, very, very seductive place. And sometimes you wouldn't even feel yourself slipping But you would be eventually going native. And one of the things, the ironies, is that we went there thinking that if we do business with them and show them how business is done, they're going to become more like us. But what more often was happening for Western businessmen is that we were adopting the local rules and starting to act more like them. And I think this may be the case with some of the professors from Harvard who got themselves mixed up with all sorts of conflicts of interest that they would have never dreamed of doing over here, just because over there everybody was doing it and that was par for the course.
Yes. Another question arises since we are going through the questions of monopoly here. Aren't there certain groups over there that we might say in the area of distribution and who knows what else exercise a monopoly via their power and enforcement through these groups that you mentioned that are
sure.
there?
Anything from alcohol and, say, alcohol and cigarette distribution is an area that is controlled by the mob, and not even Philip Morris, the maker of Marlboro, will dream of getting into that area. And the few times that they thought about it, they received kidnapping. The expats, their executives in Moscow, received kidnapping threats. Some of there was bombs set off at some of their businesses, and they all stay away from it. You know, and it goes the same thing with export of many of the steel products and aluminum. This is also controlled by virtual monopolies, which operate just like organized crime and kill people. And there's been a case of when an American company was based out of New York. They were traders. I think they were called AIOC, if memory serves me correctly. Decided to try to get into that business, and its representative in Moscow was making actually inroads, and he disappeared between passport control and the boarding gate of the Delta flight, I think it was a local flight, and his body was found 60 miles, a couple of days later, his body was found riddled with bullets 60 miles outside of Moscow, and the American company obviously withdrew from Russia. And then the monopolies, you know, go right to the huge companies like Gazprom, which controls it's the world's largest natural gas provider. I think it sits on just about half of the world's natural gas reserves, and they have a monopoly on the pipelines, on everything. And they are a state within a state. They contribute something like as much as a quarter or a fifth of Russia's federal budget. And President Putin has just put his own man in there, but you know, previously it had been run by Viktor Chernomyrdin, who was the prime minister, and then his protege Rem Vyacharev, and the monopolies in Russia are unreformed and extremely wasteful, and it's one of the reasons why, ironically, Russians sometimes will pay more for energy in Russia, even though they have so much of it, than we do in the United States.
It's overwhelming. Thank you very much.
All right. Thanks for the call. And we have about 10 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. We're talking with Matthew Brzezinski. He is now a freelance writer. His work has most recently appeared in the New York Times Magazine. Between 1996 and 98, he was a staff writer for the Wall Street Journal in Kiev and Moscow. And before that, reported from Poland and other countries in Eastern Europe for a variety of publications, including the New York Times, The Economist, The Guardian, The Toronto Globe and Mail. His book, if you'd like to read it, is titled Casino Moscow, A Tale of Greed and Adventure on Capitalism's Wildest Frontier. It's published by the Free Press. Questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. You were just talking about the difficulties that American business people faced when this economy opened up, and here was this great. They thought here was this great opportunity to make investments and do business
sure,
and
a
make money.
Untapped market.
The difficulties that they found when they got there and got on the ground and saw the rules by which things were played. Despite that, were there some American business people who also managed to get rich?
New
Russia.
Particularly, people who had been sent there by Wall Street. In between 96 to 98, Russia experienced something very similar to the dot-com bubble, where through hype and hope, I suppose, people started playing the Russian stock market, and the Russian stock market was, and I believe 1997 or maybe 96 and 97 was the world's best performing stock market. government bonds, which were a novelty for the Russians, were paying 200%. And so when some investors from the U.S. took a gamble on this and realized that within 90 days, because these were 90-day treasury bills, you could make as much money in Russia as you could sitting on U.S. bond treasury bills for decades. You had a bit of a Klondike that was born, and you had tens and tens, if not hundreds, of billions of dollars that started flowing into the stock markets. And it was a very interesting marriage between Russian gangsterism and Wall Street greed. And not surprisingly, I suppose, in hindsight, it led to the biggest bust in international financial history in August of 1998, when essentially what transpired was all these stocks and bonds turned out to be Ponzi schemes, and Western investors lost probably close to $100 billion in Russia.
We have a caller here on a cell phone. We'll get right to them. Line number 4. Hello.
Thank you very much. I have a two-part question, and I'll ask the question and then hang up and listen for the answer on the air. The two-part question is this. In your opinion, first, is capitalism irreparably damaged in the former Soviet Union? And if it isn't, then what's the best hope for capitalism there?
To answer your question, yes, capitalism is irreparably damaged in the former Soviet Union. In the new rich circles of Moscow and St. Petersburg, they're all for it, the sort of capitalism that they practice. But if you go outside, 20 miles outside of Moscow, you've entered the deep third world where people are getting by on bartering, on subsistence living, where people probably wouldn't be able to eat if they didn't have these garden plots where they planted tomatoes or potatoes or cucumbers or whatnot. And for them, what they think is capitalism, which was the sort of the Russian wild west version, is a dirty word. And during the communism, it's like as one person once told me, during communism, the government always told us capitalism was evil, and it took the fall of the collapse of communism for me to realize that the Politburo had been right all along. This is just because of the sort of capitalism that was practiced, and it has nothing to do with the sort of free market economies that we have here in the West.
Hmm. And no possibility of repair, or take some long time.
I think it's a generational question. For those people who spent most of their lives under the Soviet system, for all its faults, the average Russian lived better before 1991. They had basic services, they had salaries, they had food on their tables, they could walk the streets at night, and for them this was a shock and a horror, and for them freedom and the free market is chaos and banditry. Now what you have, the hope that you have, is that there's a very young generation, people who are today in their 20s, and people who are going abroad a lot, and of all the aid programs, of all the tens and tens of billions of dollars that U.S. taxpayers sunk into Russia, I think one of the most effective was a sort of student exchange programs where we brought in young Russians to spend a semester or a year studying in the United States, so they could walk the streets and go to the shops and see that the system can't work, and I think for me it's those young kids that when they grow up, they're the only hope for that country.
Another cell phone here, line 1. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Wanted to ask you, started in the topic on the food plots, but what's happening in the main agricultural enterprises?
Well, ironically enough, agriculture really has not been reformed in Russia, throughout most of the Soviet Union, in fact. The old collective farms, which were just about the most inefficient form of agriculture ever invented, they all are still around, and with rare exceptions, there is no private farming in Russia, and only recently has the Duma, the Russian Parliament, been making efforts even to make land privatization legal, And I've been to a number of collective farms, and it's a tragedy. You often have crops rotting in the fields because these collective farms no longer, even though they operate in the same way they did before, they no longer get the subsidies because, of course, the Russian government is effectively bankrupt and can't afford to give them the cheap loans that it used to. So they can't afford fuel for their combine harvesters, or very often they can't. The harvesters have broken down and they can't afford to fix them, so they end up selling them to neighboring farms for spare parts. And so crops rot in the field, and during the 90s, agricultural production has plummeted in Russia, and it's still very much an unreformed sector because the peasants they've gotten used to the idea that other people are going to think for them, and they're too frightened in very many cases to all of a sudden make decisions for themselves and to all of a sudden be told work for profit, and they're a very timid and passive bunch. They're very, very much living in the 19th century in the Russian farms.
Thank you.
All right, thank you. It seemed, at least at various points, that there were that the people who were doing the economic planning for the Russian government were capable enough, and some
very
of them
so, yes.
seemed to be rather savvy. Now, of course, also that there was a lot of churning of advisors. It seemed that one of the things that Mr. Yeltsin would do was keep changing his coaches every once in a while. What exactly happened? I mean, was this a failure of leadership? Was it that they just rushed into capitalism too quickly? Was it that any individual was never really given the time and support to implement his ideas?
I think ultimately it was a failure of leadership. I mean, this Yeltsin was the captain of the ship, and the ship sank under his watch. And what I was a great admirer of Yeltsin until I got to Russia. I think what he did in 1991, when he very heroically stood up on that tank and he became sort of a symbol of hope in Russia, was incredible and will go down in no question about it in the history books. However, Yeltsin ambition got the best part of Yeltsin, and by 1996. When he was up for re-election, it was clear that his health was failing him. And it was also clear that he was extremely unpopular, and he should have walked away and retired. But he didn't. He made a deal with the devil, which in this case were seven very powerful banker-type businessmen who became known as the oligarchs, and they controlled much of the sort of newly privatized media. And they made him a deal. They said, "We'll put you back in office, and you give us the keys to the treasury." And the election of 1996 was a giant scandal. We in the West sort of chose to look away because the candidate that Yeltsin was running against was a communist, and so we figured, well, you know, let there be some voting irregularities as long as Yeltsin gets back in. The problem is, once Yeltsin got back in, he essentially spent the better part of his second term in sanitariums convalescing, and he was sick, and there was nobody minding the shop. And so the oligarchs essentially ran the place, and they raped and pillaged the country. The billions, tens and tens of billions of dollars were siphoned out through the sale of natural resources. No money was reinvested, and the government, often the government's money or aid from Western organizations like the World Bank, simply disappeared. And the young reformers that we counted on so much, well, very many of them effectively were in the pockets of the oligarchs. At which time we either didn't know this or chose not to know this. In retrospect, it seems as if it was so obvious, and why didn't we see this? But this is always the case. So I blame Yeltsin, and then of course in 1999 when after the crash when freedom and the free market were sort of dirty words, And then there started to be some sort of grumblings in Moscow that perhaps Yeltsin should be prosecuted for some of this corruption. He started changing prime ministers almost on a monthly basis, looking for somebody who would be tough enough to protect him and his family. And of course, he found that in the former in former KGB agent and the former head of the FSB, as the KGB is now called, a fellow by the name of Vladimir Putin. And Putin made him a deal that that you know we will take care of you, just hand over power. And so I think Yeltsin sold the country down the river in 1996, and then he sold what was left of it in exchange for his own personal safety in 1999. And so I hold him responsible.
Well, we're going to have to stop because we've used our time, and I have somebody here I can't take my apologies, but we're just going to have to finish. We want to say, Mr. Brzezinski, thanks very much for talking with us.
Oh, it's been my pleasure.
Our guest, Matthew Brzezinski, he is now a freelance writer, a former staff writer for the Wall Street Journal, and the book, if you would like to read it, the book we've talked about is Casino Moscow, A Tale of Greed and Adventure on Capitalism's Wildest Frontier. The book is published by the Free Press.